This evening we are devoting our subject to the problem of superconscious cognition. In the first place, as we usually attempt to do at least, we must clarify our terms and understand in common our attitudes on these rather abstract matters. When we think of the extrasensory band of human faculties, or of spiritual apperceiving powers within man, such as clairvoyance and telepathy, we use general terms which perhaps are not sufficiently precise or exact to indicate the large variety of phenomena with which we are concerned. And when we see a person or become aware that an individual has performed some feat which appears to imply a kind of knowledge or perceiving power beyond our own, it is so easy simply to say, well, I guess he's psychic. Or perhaps he's a clairvoyant. And having come to this conclusion, also conclude that we have said something. Actually, we have said nothing. Yet, seldom if ever do we require any further discussion of the matter. We feel very secure in our discovery. And act as though we have really made a pronouncement of importance. Actually, what we generally consider this extrasensory gamut is made up of a universe of factors which we do not know very much about. It is quite probable that one so-called telepathic effect could be produced by any one of 100 or more causes, all somewhat different, many totally different. Thus, we are actually on the threshold of a world of values, which we have not explored, about which we have very little common thinking, and almost no common terminology. Under such conditions, it may well invite us to think through some of the levels of this problem this evening in an effort to maybe clarify or distinguish a little more clearly some of the problems and factors which must sometime become part of our general scientific knowledge, because we are moving inevitably in the direction the recognition of an extrasensory band in the human pattern of cognition faculties. First of all, how are we to judge what constitutes the normal sensory gamut? Are we sure that we all hear the same thing when we listen to sound? If we all hear the same thing, what is the individual's place in nature who is tone deaf? Unless someone points out this tone deafness to him, he may go along for a considerable time without recognizing its existence. I also know persons who are colorblind. Now, when they are so colorblind that certain complete patterns are eliminated, and they are unable to tell the difference between a green light and a red light in traffic, they generally find out their difficulty rather quickly. But how many degrees of color blindness pass unconsidered and unnoticed? Now, Artist told me some years ago that a very great painter could distinguish about 475 shades of red. How many can we distinguish? Well, perhaps red, vermilion, carmine, and all the colors that are not red. How much can we really say our faculties reveal to us? Also, what circumstances might cause faculties to change or be in one way or another distorted? Further than this, how do we know to what degree our sensory perceptions are influenced by preconceptions or by attitudes of our own? We say that persons can develop a blind spot if they do not want to see something. Now, this does not literally mean, in most cases, that they are not able to visually register the object. They may be blind to its meaning, but can they be blind to the object itself? Under hypnosis, yes, definitely. They can be told that a certain object is not there. If they believe what they are told, they are absolutely unable to see the object, although it is there. Or they may be told that an object is there which is not there, and they will be able to see it. Under hypnosis, an individual can listen to music that is not being played and hear it. What is he hearing? The person under hypnotic suggestion who sees the living room rug turn into a mill pond but take off his shoes and stockings and wade around in the water, what kind of water is it? To him it is wet and cold, but to no one else is it even visible. Thus it we know that under suggestions of various kinds, it is perfectly possible to see something that is not there. It is also possible to see something there, which has no existence, or not to see something that has existence. The same of odor, the same of the sense of touch. It is perfectly possible for an individual to feel something touching his body, which does not exist, if he is told and is willing to believe what he's told. Thus, our sensory perceptions are constantly being conditioned by a kind of suggestion. If under hypnosis an individual is told that a deceased relative comes into the room and shakes hands with him, he will see that relative come in and will shake hands with that relative and feel that that relative's hand in his own is just as solid as his own hand. Yet there is no one there. We know this is true. Therefore, we know that we can see persons not present. We know we can be made to see animal forms or monsters that are not present. We know also that we can be caused to feel or believe that we have journeyed into another place. And the individual can be caused to believe completely and entirely that he has left his living room and has gone to Paris and is in the elevator riding up to the top of the Tour Eiffel or Eiffel Tower. He can be made to see this, believe it, and know it, and can be caused to be so certain of it that no doubt whatever remains in his own mind. What happened? We know, therefore, that the sensory perceptions can be influenced. And we know that the principal influencing factor is suggestion. We also know that it is perfectly possible for the mind to be influenced by association and fear. The man walking in the forest sees a broken twig or stick on the path, thinks that it may be a serpent, and immediately he sees a serpent. But in the flipness of a second look assures him that it is not a serpent, so he continues on his way. But for the instant, he is fully certain that the snake is the serpent he suspected it of being. This phenomenon is too frequently recorded not to be noted and recognized. Always, then, we have some mysterious power which we generally regard as a suggestion power. This can not only affect our thoughts, but it can affect our sensory reflexes of sight, hearing, and sound, taste and touch, the sense of smell, by which we can smell odors that have no existence simply by being told that they exist. I've also seen and participated in experiments in which colorblindness was instantaneously produced so that the individual, under suggestion, lost all color consciousness of blue or red or yellow, and when shown an infinite variety of articles, described them without this color. And, for instance, when shown, we will say for the moment that blue was eliminated from his mind. When shown an object of the color of green, instantly identified it as yellow. He lost the blue factor. Doing this repeatedly under all kinds of tests, it would not be possible for it to be fabricated successfully. And there was no motive. So we know that these productions of the mind must be taken under consideration, especially when we are further aware that everyone is constantly suggesting to himself something of that which he desires or against of which he has prejudices or about which in some way or other he does not have a completely neutral and therefore factual attitude. The second thing that then we have to also consider is, in addition to this factor of suggestion, the degree of perception interference which we have in ordinary problems of observation. The individual today perceives upon two levels simultaneously. He perceives factually and he perceives psychologically. He sees two ways at the same time. He sees what there is and he sees what interests him. And these things are two different factors in many instances. If the mind, hastening on to a desired perception, seeing what it wants to see, moves along through a series of non-desired circumstances, these are passed with indifference. There is little, if any, conscious recognition that these things have even been seen, and the mind hastens to embrace the object with which it was interested or concerned. The old story of Sherlock Holmes is, of course, one of the classical examples, in which Holmes suddenly turns to Dr. Watson and says, "How many stairs are there leading up to our room in Baker Street here?" And Watson, who had been over the stairs thousands of times, could not tell, because there had never been sufficient interest to cause him to count them. Yet we also know that under suggestion, Watson would know, because subconsciously those stairs are recorded, but not consciously. If, therefore, we are consciously hastening toward a certain condition, we may be subjectively registering a wide variety of phenomena, which at the moment is of no particular interest to us, certainly not sufficiently vital to make any conscious contribution to our awareness. Yet all this information is available to us and is locked within a kind of filing system from which it can be drawn out in two ways, either by a technique, such as hypnosis or suggestion, or by a natural technique, which is referred to as association mechanism. When there is some particular reason by which this particular submerged idea plays into a pattern, it may suddenly be remembered or brought into conscious awareness again. Now, in awareness of this kind, this double awareness, conscious and subconscious, operating together, the conscious is a rather prosaic thing, heavily indoctrinated with prejudices, opinions, and beliefs, seeing only what it desires to see, seeing good only where it wishes to see good, and evil where it wishes to see evil. But beneath this conditioned faculty perception is the subconscious, unconditioned acceptance of facts. Now, this subjective factual acceptance is usually more observant than our conscious faculty, because it is not conditioned and because it is not penalized by our moods and attitudes, nor is it educated into a kind of sensory dishonesty, as is the case usually with our conscious faculty. We are told, for instance, in the sphere of art, that no matter how peculiar, how unpleasant, how even displeasing an art example may be, that if we are able to see it often enough, or if it comes into vogue and is frequently brought to our attention, we can become accustomed to it, accept it, and finally discover no longer any asymmetry or disproportion in it. The object has not changed, but we have changed our attitude toward it. This happens in connection with styles, with clothing, with models of automobiles, with types of furniture, which cause us sometimes to divide so markedly between the new and the old, discarding the old only because it is not new, and accepting the new only because it is not old, having no validity behind our attitude. And frequently, not accepting the new for some time until we become accustomed to it. Let us then apply this now to animate situations, rather than merely to furniture and houses and roads. Let us say that when we meet a person, we instinctively, objectively, make acceptances and rejections on the level of the familiar or on the level of conscious or semi-conscious association. If this person has taste like our own, the person is admirable, obviously. If they happen to remind us of someone we like, they have a pleasing personality. If they wear the kind of clothes we admire, they have good taste. If they talk about subjects that interest us, they are intelligent and up to the moment. If they belong to the same club, they're practically brethren under the skin. So by the time we have taken our acceptances based upon, possibly, a predisposition to like the person, we have come into a very sympathetic and very pleasant relationship. But it is quite possible that the discerning faculties of our inner sensory structure, uncontaminated by our good fellowship, have seen many things that consciously we have not seen at all, have made note of all kinds of little nuances, little phrases and words that mean the opposite to what we think they mean. Hesitation in admitting certain situations that we've passed over, but to these other faculties might indicate ulterior motives. And little by little, these inner faculties have come to a far more complete picture of this person than we have. So if the inner faculties of the outer appearance of judgment come finally to a variance of some kind, we may suddenly get a hunch. We get an intuitive feeling that this person whom we think is so admirable may not be quite as admirable as we think they are. We get a flash of some kind. I had a grandmother that had flashes of that nature almost constantly. Sometimes she was right, sometimes she was wrong. When she was wrong, she always forgot it. When she was right, she always remembered it and developed quite a reputation as far as her own thinking was concerned as a sensitive. She was very psychic. This type of thing, it's not perhaps quite as ridiculous as it sounds, because it does mean that we get feelings off people. We know that we have faculties of discrimination better than we use, and that we see more than we know that we see, and hear more that we know than that we know we hear. Thus, we do have two levels of judgment. A quick judgment based upon the passing testimonies of senses pretty well conditioned, and a slower judgment arising from thoughtfulness and reflection. And if this slower judgment simply cannot break through at any other time or in any other way because of its meeting a very highly opinionated exterior, it may come to you in sleep, in dream symbols, causing us to see episodes or incidents involving these persons whom we have met, and by which something about them that we never noticed becomes highly dramatized. Later, perhaps, we learn that this internal apperception was true, that this person was more like our hunch than our original estimation. We say to ourselves, my goodness, I'm really quite psychic. I just do this all the time. I just didn't even like to admit it to myself. It's all very wonderful. Actually, it is not any indication of an extrasensory faculty at all. It merely represents the different levels upon which our normal faculties can function. But as we are aware of only one level of function, anything else to us is miraculous and mysterious, and we have to develop exaggerated ideas about it. We've already discussed on a number of occasions a point also that is of very great importance, and one which we so often overlook, particularly in matters relating to sensory delusion. Anyone who has had delirium tremens or has developed advanced case of hashish eating or something of that nature. We trust none of our friends are in that group. We'll record optical illusionary phenomena that is not due necessarily to hypnosis at all, but may be due to hypnotic drugs, such as the yogi cult among our Indians, and the hashish used by the Hassani, or the effects of the assassins in Persia. We do, however, have another example of this that is getting quite prevalent, and we're all getting close to it, and it can sometimes perhaps cause a considerable amount of complications. That is the use of these hypnotic drugs for sedation, for narcotics, and for anesthesia, and also in the terminal stages of advanced ailments. As a result of these uses of drugs, optical phenomena may be experienced by the sick who are not addicted to any unhappy habit under normal conditions. And we have had considerable record recently of extreme disturbance among the sick due to the use of some of these drugs, by which the most terrible experiences resembling nightmares and the like are recorded, involving visual phenomena of a most grotesque or even terrifying nature. Thus, this type of visual phenomena can occur, as the result of narcotics, and also as the result of certain excessive psychoses within the individual himself. He can force them or cause them to occur in his own life. Without the essential use of hypnosis, it is possible and is recorded that individuals capable of imagination or internal imagery, these rather sensitive persons who can create imaginary worlds within their lives, particularly as defenses and escapes from the pressure of externals, individuals who can create phantom lives for themselves through what we call daydreaming. Under some conditions, these phantom lives can be projected into the sensory equipment and can actually be visually animated. Thus, a person we have only imagined might and could very well sometime appear objectively as though in a room with us. A projection by the mind. Now, this projection is not a projection of a form outside of ourselves, but a projection of a mental image within the mental structure itself. And this mental image is placed in the same field that is receiving the image of the exterior room in which we are standing or sitting. Therefore, this image becomes involved in the room. But like a double exposure upon a photographic plate, the image is usually to some degree transparent or semi-transparent, permitting the objects in the room to be seen through and around the image itself. This has often given rise to the idea of ghosts. And there are certain ghosts that are undoubtedly projected mental images, because we can visualize ideas and give them form within ourselves. And this form can be mixed into our visual process so that it appears to be imposed upon a situation or scene outside of ourselves. This means that we can create ghosts. This does not necessarily mean that we create all ghosts. But it causes us to say that the mere fact that an individual has seen something is no more a proof of clairvoyance than is delirium tremens a proof of clairvoyance, or some fantasy observed as a result of an overtoxic situation arising from acute alcoholism. These situations all demand analysis and study. And as yet, no effort has been made really to analyze them or to divide them one from another. The next question that would naturally come to our mind is, presuming that we have five sensory perceptions, is it possible, is it reasonable to assume that all of these perceptions have overtones? Is there any place in which we can say with certainty, at this point, the area of a sensory perception must inevitably end? We know that such is certainly not the case with hearing, because various scientific experiments in connection with deafness and semi-deafness have indicated that the individual's hearing can be artificially increased so that he may hear sounds not normally audible to himself or to other persons. We also know that there are certain kinds of high vibration sounds, such as certain dog whistles, which can be bought, which will call a dog and which you cannot hear. But the dog can. There is much to indicate that animals can hear sounds that we cannot hear. And we know that Indians on the reservations have unusual hearing, which is lost to us because of the compensation of other faculties which we have developed. So that one Indian on a reservation down in New Mexico could clearly and definitely distinguish the ticking of a watch in a man's pocket over 100 feet away. He could tell when the watch was stopped. We cannot hear that. It is possible that some animals could hear it. We do not know how acute hearing can be. Nor do we know what it would mean to things that we normally hear if our hearing range came to include things which we do not normally hear. Supposing, for example, we were listening to a fine orchestration, and suddenly our hearing faculties were enlarged. Would this mean that, like high fidelity, we would enjoy it more? Or would this development, for which there was no compensation in our orchestration, result in our music suddenly turning into inharmony or into chaos, because it would no longer be catering to certain preconceived levels and tonal developments which we now regard as harmonious? I remember one occasion, Benjamin Franklin tells the story of how he was enjoying a certain bit of music that was being played, and the poor dog under the window was dying from it, miserable and howling and groaning. But to him, the music sounded fine. If we had a different sight for hearing, would we enter into a different kind of sound world? And under such conditions, would the present sound world merely represent a part of this new world? Or would this larger hearing force us to change our entire concept and cause us to find all the sounds that we now hear inharmonious? It is quite possible that it would. That a change of the limitation of our gamut would require a complete reorganization of our entire tonal concept and a re-education of our entire mental attitude toward sound. This could be quite important. I remember years ago in New York, I had a friend who was an opera singer, gained some reputation in the field, came for the first time to listen to some very high-class Chinese classical music. The opera singer in question was rather given to the Italian school. And after a few minutes of Chinese classics, declared that they'd never heard such a horrible series of noises in their lives that could not be considered music. Later, my Chinese friend told me that his opinion of the Italian composers was identically the same. Now, this means something. It means one of two things. Either in racial differences, there are different tonal acceptances, or that the acceptance and rejection of harmony is conditioned by familiarity and repetition, and that things to us are harmonious and beautiful merely because we have become accustomed to them. Whereas that which is not harmonic is merely that with which we are not accustomed. That was Wagner's contention. The only reason why we are offended by enharmonic intervals is simply because we are not accustomed to them. And he proceeded to use them in composition with great success. Everyone said it was terrible when he did it. 50 years later, everyone said it was wonderful. It was just a change in the thinking of the people. So we know that one way or another, sound can be affected, influenced. Now what about things seen? Realizing that the seeing of something may have a profound effect upon the entire psychic life of the individual. Could we go so far as to agree with Buddha that the five senses make the person? And that if anything happened to these five senses so that they carry different testimony from what they carry now, the person would be a different person. Some way we are nourished by the acceptance of these sensory reflexes and build our lives around these acceptances. If then we could see something we do not see now, would any part of our world remain unchanged? Supposing we could add a clear extra perception to the higher or to the lower end of our visual scale. And suppose in the moment of so doing, we suddenly came into a universe with different dimensions from those that we know today. It is quite possible that even one or two steps higher or lower in our visual scale would completely change our relation to space, because that extension might fill space with things always there but as yet unseen. We might suddenly find ourselves surrounded by people, races, creatures that have always been here, but about which we have no conscious realization. This was the burden of the thinking of Socrates at the time of his last discourse, when he declared that he perceived people living along the shores of the air as men live along the shores of the sea. Supposing this universe is populated with many forms of life that we do not know, and that science fiction has a certain basis, then the moment we contacted those forms of life, the moment we contacted levels of ourselves previously unknown, perhaps our entire materialism would fall to pieces, for our way of life is developed from the gamut of our sensory perceptions. Change any of these perceptions and we change the entire pattern of our existence. For this reason, the question has again been raised. Is there any evidence that man's perceptions are changing, basically? Have we any reasonable justification for assuming that 1,000 years from now, or 10,000 years from now, we will have a different sensory orientation from what we have today, and that many things now regarded as mystical or mysterious or metaphysical will in that time become part of the common faculty allotment of the individual? This is a tricky question. I don't intend to evade it or avoid it, but it is not a question on which prophecy can safely be made. Go back now to consider what has been the story of man's sensory perception gamut. It would seem that man's perceptions have always been in conflict, that he has possessed a subjective, metaphysical or mystical perception field, that this is very clear and well developed in primitive people in comparison to the development in modern sophisticated man. Therefore, we would appear to find a gradual diminishing of these extrasensory faculties over a long period of time, that in all probabilities our remote ancestors, 10,000, 50,000 years ago, were more psychic than we are, that gradually the objectification of our way of life and the building of ever greater dependency upon external things and the loss of the need for these subjective factors. These factors have caused them to decrease in acuteness. For example, man today does not need the defensive mechanism of the squirrel. He does not need the protective devices which are found in primitive animals. He does not need the almost psychical apperception of the savage man, who had to survive in a world of constant dangers and hazards. Thus, those faculties which enable primitive man, perhaps, to detect the presence of an animal that was stalking him, these faculties are no longer valuable to him. He is no longer stalked by animals in the jungle. He is now shouted at by television commercials. The end is the same. Both the animal and the television announcement are out to get him. But instead of needing highly sensitive faculties to get the warning, today he must tune the machine down because the warning is so loud he can hear nothing else. So that these sensitive things disappear, and man, generally speaking, appears to be ever less sensitive with the passing of time. On the other hand, man is gradually moving away from this materialistic integration. He is beginning to recognize that he is moving towards problems which he cannot solve. And the pressure of externals is forcing him to search for internal values and resources. So it would seem that somewhere this process of the gradual loss of extrasensory faculties slows down, finally reverses itself, and that over a long period of time, these faculties will be intensified again. For in both cases, they were for purposes of survival. Man became materially objective in order to survive in a material world. His material world and his survival here are now hazarded by other factors. These other factors demand subjective sensory awareness. So in all probabilities, he will ultimately develop it. Whether he will develop it rapidly is a question. But I think the researchers at Duke indicate definitely that in some persons, there is an extension of faculty, not generally diffused at this time, but present in enough individuals to establish a pattern and to indicate that in all probabilities, a degree of extrasensory power is in every person. But this degree remains comparatively undeveloped in many persons. Why it should be developed in some and not in others is still a philosophical problem. But I suspect strongly that it has to do with the focus of the personality in terms of material interest. We know, for example, that most primitive people who were searching for internal cognition or trying to develop superphysical faculties did so by departing from the ordinary way of life, and especially by prayer and fasting. And the entire history of mysticism indicates that the reduction of the food content has a tremendous amount to do with the development of extrasensory faculties. The American Indian proved this. Among your early Christian mystics, this was clearly indicated. And among your great teachers, Jesus, Zoroaster, Buddha, all of these leaders are known as ascetics. But they departed from worldliness and in most instances engaged in extensive fast, as also did Pythagoras. This fasting especially lowers the sugar content in the brain and seemingly results in a clarification of faculties by the reduction of toxins. If, therefore, false visions and delusions arise from toxins, intoxication, clearer vision or clear sight seems to arise from the purification of the body from such conditions as might normally interfere with hypersensitivity. We note also that where individuals suffer from psychic problems, that nearly all we can assist these persons by the regulation of their diet, and that a psychic intensity has to have a certain type of nutrition in order to flourish. A negative psychic condition nearly always depends upon some kind of a diet that is heavy in the wrong type of food, or is deficient in those kinds of foods which have a tendency to prevent supersensory experiences of one kind or another. For example, an individual who is having psychic trouble will very often correct the situation almost instantly by increasing his intake of protein and sugar. This means that protein and sugar have a tendency to prevent certain types of internal experience. Now, let me warn you against the danger of trying this in reverse and attempting to develop spiritual values and propensities by dropping these items from your diet or restricting them. If you try it, you will get into trouble. Because the individual, unless he has certain basic groundwork, cannot orient himself in any of these situations. And nearly always, your so-called extrasensory gamut comes as a very serious problem into the life of the individual who attempts to cause it by any artificial means whatsoever. Only when it is the inevitable consequence of normal functions or patterns long established can it be endured. And we warn seriously against any effort to experiment with this type of thing. It is not good, because it represents, as in the case of your mystic and ascetic, your ancient holy man, your priest and your prophet, a kind of dedication of the total life. It has nothing whatever to do with dabbling or experimenting in the term that we use today. But now we have exhausted another possibility which explains certain phenomena with which we are concerned. Psychology has taught us the importance of remembering that a large part of man's psychic life is influenced by the happenings of his early life. We are, many of us, influenced, therefore, by modifying conditions in our own early lives of which we have no conscious memory. There are very many associations, situations, reports, which were we to suddenly discover them today, we would regard as evidence of mystical faculties. But in reality, they are only memories that have always been there, but which have not been brought into objectivity. We also recognize that in psychical phenomena, which is quite common, a great part of it, not all, we don't say all, but a great part of it, can be attributed to the inconsistency which exists between the surface person and the subjective person. 500 years ago, the four faces of Eve would have been treated on the steps of the cathedral as demoniacal possessions. 200 years ago, it would have been treated for the same thing, but not on the steps of the cathedral. Now it is passed over as a psychological phenomenon of interest. No one gets very excited over it, except the idea of creating a book which is going to produce a reasonable revenue to the author and publisher. Actually, you have here in this problem of multiple personality merely an indication of the different beings inside of ourselves. The four faces all had their own temperaments, their own attitudes, their own dispositions, and part of the time, separate existence. Well, this is not so common. Usually, this separate existence situation is merged in a confusion, and we do not find too much separate existence. Maybe a little occasionally operating in the daydream, in the sleep phenomena, or perhaps in temporary pressures of personality. But actually, we do have a great many different individuals who can play various parts in our lives and can, under certain conditions, appear to us as separate persons. Let us take for a very simple fact that in a dream, any psychic area of pressure which we may have within ourselves can be, and usually is, symbolically impersonated as an individual. Thus, someone appearing to us, either in dream or so-called vision, may be the symbolical personification of a pressure, of an attitude, of a psychic tension within our own nature, or one of the symbolical parts of the psychic field itself, the various parts of which play such an involved and confused role in the numerous aspects of our personality. Ordinary individuals in their daily lives move along through the day, the month, and the year, and as far as they know, they are always one person. I question it very much. And I think if you will analyze this fact carefully, you will question it very much. You will realize that you are a nice, quiet, placid individual until a situation of a certain nature arose. Then suddenly you became highly defensive, extremely suspicious, critical, tyrannical, short-tempered. Then, slowly this faded away, accompanied perhaps by a general depletion. You didn't feel very good after this outburst. So you had to take a little rest. And you finally got back again to the normal state of this kindly, good-natured disposition that you were acquainted with. Then everything went along very well until your neighbor suddenly got a new automobile. Then suddenly, for no reason at all, a very avaricious genius began to develop inside of you and take on demoniacal proportions. Anything good that happened to that neighbor was a cosmic misfortune as far as you were concerned. You did not wish them any bad luck, but you hoped they'd never have any good luck with that car. You suddenly stopped in your tracks. You said, is this me? I'm a nice person. Why should I want something unhappy to happen to my neighbor because he's fortunate enough to have a better car? Well, the only reason why I feel the way I do is because he doesn't deserve that car. It should have belonged to me. I'm the one that deserves it. He's no good. I'm a hard-working man. He gets a new car. I drive one 5 years old. So I think I shall have a long thought on what we're going to do about changing administration at the next election. And after a while, this gets tiresome, so we drop back into the normal pattern of being good-natured people again. Then all of a sudden, the little boy gets sick. Suddenly, our good-natured selves become a monument of fear, terror almost. We love this child. We've got to do something quick. For the last 5 years, we've been telling everyone how little we thought of doctors. But the little boy is sick, so the first thing we do is phone the quickest one, the nearest one we can find. You say afterwards, was that me that did that? I'm not supposed to like doctors. Then something else comes along. And this child, the sickness of this child, suddenly we forget all kinds of things that were important. We didn't talk very much about religion. We thought that religion was something that other people needed. And all of a sudden, we begin to wonder if perhaps we should do a little praying for that child. And we suddenly realize what the men used to say and what they meant when they said there were very few atheists in foxholes during the war. Trouble has hit us. All of a sudden, our universe isn't sufficient anymore, and a whole new personality comes through us. A personality essentially atavistic. What we would like and what we would accept instantly is the rattle and the fetish of the medicine man if it would only get that little boy well again. We begin to wonder whether a miracle could be performed and how we would go about to order one. Then after a while, the little fellow gets better. It all sinks back again. And all the time, there are different people coming through us. Under every different type of stimulation or association mechanism, something else comes out of it. It has been there all the time. The nasty temper fit was there all the time we had such a nice disposition. fear was there all the time that we were perfectly sure of ourselves. Envy was there when we were perfectly contented. All these things are there. Now, when they start moving out, as though someone lifted the lid of Pandora's box, we come face to face with ourselves as we have never known ourselves. And under such conditions, we may be excused if some of ourselves remind us a little bit of some of the imperfection that we've read about. Could we be this way? Or are we obsessed? Has some demon taken possession of us? Back in the Middle Ages, it was very easy. Anytime you didn't live the way you believed you should, it was a demon responsible, because nobody had any faults of their own. Today we begin to wonder whether it is an imp of darkness whispering in our ears or just an ordinary streak in ourselves. Now we begin to know that it is this streak in ourselves. So that there are the selves in us, better than we know, worse than we know, different. There is the artist and the businessman, the musician and the carpenter, the carpenter and the banker, all these crisscrossing, which make us very complicated human beings, and on the surface only a little personality with a conventional appearance, which we generally regard as ourselves. Actually, this little personality is not ourselves. It is merely a puppet that we're holding on one hand, like a marionette in the Punch and Judy show. The great operation is going on underneath and behind, and practically unnoticed. With this larger operation taking place, things are happening every moment that are not to be easily explained in our everyday philosophy. These things, to some of us, mean nothing. They just pass unconsidered. But to another type of mind, or to any type of mind, under certain conditions, these things become omens, of great signs and shadows of impending events. All kinds of strange things move and stir within us when we become sensitive to the profound diffusion of our own internal life. All this has to be considered. All these elements have to be examined before we can go on and affirm or assume that there is anything miraculous. And then we come face to face with the famous Paracelsian axiom, which is very, very wise and very good. Namely, that there is no such a thing as a miracle. So that a miracle is an effect, the cause of which is unknown, but must be equal to the effect that it produces, because we live in a lawful universe. Consequently, these various faculty perceptions which seem to escape into some wild world of unbelievable magic or mystery, all these strange stories that tie in with Indian sorcery and Tibetan magic, somewhere all these stories belong in a lawful universe. And the moment we lose orientation of lawfulness, we begin to slip into a strange miasma which will quickly intoxicate us, demoralize us, and totally disintegrate and destroy our sense of equilibrium, common sense.